Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Welcome to Lost in the Static, everybody. How are you doing today?
Welcome. I'm doing just fine. How are you doing, Qdoba?
I'm doing okay.
That's your new nickname, just because he's wearing a Qdoba shirt.
Well, that's where I work, so.
I'm just saying, Qdoba. So.
Okay.
Well, all right. Do you want to do the Adam and Eve promo tonight?
No, please. Go right ahead.
You go to adamandeve.com. Use the promo code STATIC. It's a great code, STATIC. You get 3 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, free U.S. shipping, and 50% off of a single item. I brain farted there for a second, but I did it.
I was wondering where that was going to come from.
I was like, I couldn't remember which ones I had already said and which ones I had not.
Hey,
so
that's
there.
Okay.
Well, maybe next week you won't gimp it up.
Maybe. I'm not going to really, you know, push it, but we'll see. Because I don't want to vex myself.
Oh, you're not so
jinx
subtle.
Jinx myself, exactly.
All right, well, as we promised last week, we're going to be talking about the history of the video game console wars. Now, Scott and I, with our age, we were technically alive for the entire home console wars.
Right, but
we were two when they really started. Yeah, we didn't really remember it, but we were there technically.
And at least system-wise, for systems that I've owned, I can tell you that I started with an Atari 2600.
In the 80s or in the 70s still?
It would have been...
Because that was around since 77, but lasted well into the 80s. So I know a lot of people that didn't get one until the 80s.
This was just after we moved to Muncie, so it would have probably been either 78 or 79. Because it would have been short. Yeah, it was shortly because I remember my sister playing it. So it would have been shortly before she went to Brazil, and we followed her thereafter. So, it would have been 78 or 79.
You see, I never had an Atari. My first system was an NES because my parents just never wanted to do that. And as we've talked about before, I spent all my money at the arcade. So it was, why do we need to spend at that time, exorbitant amount on this stuff? Because remember, after Warner Brothers bought Atari, which we'll get into more in a little bit, they actually rose the price. Instead of the price going down as consoles tend to do, Warner Brothers said, no, raise the price. People will pay it.
This thing is still popular. We're gonna milk it for what we can. And that was actually one of the lessons learned.
There's the Warner Brothers tenure was not at Atari, did not work out very well.
Right.
But let's start at the beginning. You actually had the Odyssey prior to all this, but that really wasn't a video game system, and it's not really considered a video game system. It's just considered the first home, you're able to do what you want on the screen, and it's got a game or two in it.
Yeah, and it was basically Pong, if I remember, was the big seller.
It wasn't even called Pong, but yeah, it was basically what would be, right. I think it was table tennis or something like that.
Or Ganip Ganop, something like that,
yeah.
Which, for those of you not paying attention, is ping pong backwards.
And do you know what's really funny about the Odyssey? Ralph Baer, who invented that, this shows just how much patents and what you can patent has changed. He patented the very idea.
Yes.
Of being able to put something electronic on the screen that you control.
Yep.
Basically, his patent said, I own the concept of video games. Of course, that later changed when court said, actually, no, you've never been able to copyright or trademark an idea, so you can't patent it either. But basically, he later sued Atari, saying that they ripped him off by not actually copying anything he did, just copying the idea of a video game at home.
Right. He tried. I'll give him credit for that. He tried.
He overreached a lot, I think.
Well,
but,
yeah.
But the first real home one was one I'm unfamiliar with, you're unfamiliar with. Play the ad, and then we'll talk a little bit about what we know about the Fairchild Channel F.
Yes. It sounds a little bit like this.
Channel F.
All
all the fun. The Fairchild Video Entertainment System at your larger JCPenney. The home entertainment system that never gets old. Plug in a new video card and change the fun. Play tic-tac-toe, shooting gallery, or just doodle. Switch video cards and play Desert Fox. Switch again, it's blackjack. Or play the two built-in games, pro hockey or tennis champ. Channel F for fun. The Fairchild Video Entertainment System. Just $169.95. Video card cartridges, $19.95 each. At your larger JCPenney.
At your larger JCPenney.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's what I like at the end. You small JCPenneys, fuck you. You ain't getting no Channel F.
Well, I mean, the larger JCPenney, JCPenney is always, it's a, for those unfamiliar, it is a U.S.-based department store. And
you can also mail order from, too.
Yeah, you could also mail order at the, at, and JCPenney back, you know, back in the day when it actually meant something, they were known mainly for their clothing and perfumes and stuff. And then
they carried a lot of toys, though. They were very family. Everything you would need for your family, especially at Christmas time. Remember the JCPenney catalogs? How we'd go crazy.
And
the Sears, that like 8-page toy section in the middle.
But JCPenney, when they first started their electronics department, this was one of the big sellers for stores big enough to have an electronics department. You would have TVs and home stereos and such, and then the Fairchild Channel F came along. And I like how in this commercial, one of the big selling points is the idea of cartridges, because at that time,
memory
that was,
was science fiction. That internal was, memory, yeah.
That was foreign to a lot of people. You know, computers at that time, 76, we're still home computers. We're talking the Apple IIe has just come out. And the idea of a screen and programming your own video games kind of blows people away. But it was something that you would get in magazines and put in each line of code and then run the executable. Or it wasn't even an executable at that time. You would just run the program at the time. And this idea of being able to switch out cartridges was new.
Yeah, that you've got all these games, which by all, don't get excited. I mean, all like the 20 games that were available before the Fairchild failed. But at that time, that was a lot. That was a lot of choice.
Well,
and
yeah.
In a lot of cases, the games were just essentially repackages of the same thing. Like, hey, look, it's table tennis. No, now we've changed the net in the middle. Now it's volleyball. And, you know, it's essentially the same thing with just a slight cosmetic change. And they go, look, new game.
Well, Atari did that with their 2600, and especially that game Combat.
Yeah.
You remember it had, you know, 32 gazillion game modes.
Yeah, which is just slight variations of the last one. Hey, this one is like 4 pixels faster than the last
one. Well, you know, this one you've got 3 planes versus 1 big plane. This one you've got 2 planes versus 2 planes. This one you've got 1 plane versus 1 plane. This one, this is a genuinely different mode. You've got tanks. This one you've got tanks with bouncy walls, which was always my favorite.
Oh, yeah. I love ricocheting bullets and hitting the other guy.
Ricocheting?
No, it's an old Bugs Bunny thing. He always says ricocheted, so I just like that. You know, he doesn't say ricochet, he says ricocheted. It's
okay.
A Bugs Bunny thing. You know, I'm a big Warner Brothers cartoon fan.
But the very following year,
well,
something...
We're going to talk about the Fairchild a little bit more.
Okay.
The Fairchild did not do very well.
No.
It was one of those, like Mike Robinson likes to say on Live Nude Geeks, sometimes it's not best to be the first, it's best to be the best.
Right.
Because the first guy just ends up being the one that gets screwed. That is absolutely fair in the Fairchild's case.
Yeah.
Atari saw what the Fairchild did with the removable cartridges and everything, and they basically improved it, streamlined it, made the graphics better, made the sound better, had a better controller. And they just destroyed the Fairchild.
Charged less for the console and more for the games.
Yes, it were which would become the mantra for the video game system now is, once you've got the console, hardware is not where we make our money. It's software that we make our money.
Exactly.
So the Fairchild died relatively quickly. It only lasted about 2 years. And that last year, it was hanging over the edge the entire time.
Right.
And then we come to... Even before the Atari, we had this one you and I, again, were totally unfamiliar with. I had never even heard of the Bally Astrocade before. See,
no, well, let's talk about where Bally came from, because
the pinball.
Well, I was going to say, you talk about Bally now, and a lot of people think gyms and fitness equipment and stuff like that, which
I think pinball machines, because that's, well, I remember them, that Bally logo was at all the arcades.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, after they started out in fitness equipment.
See, and that I did not realize. I never put it together that the Bally Fitness and the Bally Pinball were
same
the same
company.
I never put that together before, just right now.
Same company. And then when they got out of fitness for a while, they got into pinball and video arcade games and stuff like that. And they saw what the Fairchild Channel F did, and they went, "Eh, we can do this better." And, you know, we're used to making games anyway. So
now the ad we're going to play is actually from 1982, which is the last year the Bally was available. But they were around since 1977.
Exactly.
So what they're talking about a little bit in this is out of date for where we are in the timeline right now. But this is the Bally Astrocade 1982 version.
Astrocade. The professional video game system that gives you four-player capability, three built-in games, a calculator, and these new cartridges. Creative Crayon. Even the young can make beautiful pictures. The Incredible Wizard has a dungeon of surprises for you. You can even create your own games with Astrocade Basic, the easy computer teaching cartridge. Astrocade, the home entertainment sensation that's a personal computer, too.
And, the interesting thing about the Astrocade, this was the first system to play with a light pen.
Yes, which was pretty revolutionary home technology at the time. Obviously, the military and, you know, whatnot had been using this for years, but for home use, that was pretty revolutionary, honestly.
Yeah, and so and again, for those unfamiliar with a light pen, it's a pen that you actually touch your screen with, and doing some creative math, it kind of knows its position and what you want to do. And the light pen tried to be a thing for a long time. And this is pre-mouse. The mouse hadn't really caught on. It's not pre-mouse technology, but it's pre-mouse
being integrated into the home
thing. Yeah. And so the light pen tried to be a thing. And Bally took a very interesting trick start to this one. Number one, you notice they said three built-in games: Fairchild Channel F, two, the extra colors, the extra calculator. I mean, the big selling point of a calculator. Woo! But it was a selling point
back then. That was because everyone did not have a calculator in their phone or in their watch like you would in the later 80s, and that, you know, being able to just plug in some numbers and do your taxes, that was a kind of a plus.
It's kind of a big deal. And then the ability, of course, to program your own games, which, God, that had the input devices. I didn't see a keyboard. I saw their little calculator layout on the front, and I saw a couple of what were obviously meant to be game controllers. And oh man, I can't imagine what that was like. But it was there.
And like I said, this lasted till 82 was their last real year. I think they hung on for another year, but again, no one noticed. And all of this was due to our next system, the Atari 2600, or the VCS system, as Atari always called it.
Right.
This is the one that made, because like I said, the Channel F and the Astrocade, those, you know, some people had them, but they were not million sellers.
Right.
Then the 2600 comes in, and these things are everywhere. Video games are the key word now. They created a cultural phenomena that the Astrocade and the Fairchild wished they could have.
Right. And they did so, again, by making the console more affordable. I believe, let's see here, the Fairchild and Channel F was introduced at $170.
Yep.
I believe the Bally Astrocade sold at $160 or $150.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that price point. And then when Atari hit, it was the first sub-$100 system. $99.99.
And $30. Okay, keep in mind, guys, this is 70s dollars. $30 per game.
Right.
Which is really astronomical when you adjust for inflation.
It's,
that would be like asking you to pay $80 for a new game today, and we already bitch about $60 new games today.
Yeah, and $60, $70 games today, $30 back then, it's about, you know, about equivalent to 80 modern U.S. dollars. But the Atari 2600, because the console was less, more people could get it.
And they came up with the unique solution that, again, would be followed for a while. They stopped doing this at, you know, by the newer generations of pack-in game. Now, like the Fairchild Net had built-in games, but the Atari had pack-in games. You know, initially it was Space Invaders. And then after that, you had Pac-Man. Remember that horrendous...
Well, it was the horrendous version of Pac-Man.
Yeah,
Could you do me a favor and move your mic a little bit closer to your mouth?
Am I too far away?
Yeah, you're okay, too far. Bring it to the side and end up.
Okay.
I mean, right next door. Don't be shy.
Yeah.
Sorry, it was...
Is it just bugging you?
No, you've been echoey the last few episodes, and it's because you keep your mic down here.
I'm sorry, that's the way...
Yeah, up here. I know.
Fair enough.
I know.
But yeah, it... Atari... Pre-Warner Brothers was a very well-run company.
Yes.
They knew what they were doing. They paid their people well. I mean, you know, they saw potential in these smelly hippies guys like, what was their names? Wozni Jobs, I think?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, these literally were smelly hippies that showed up on their door. He said they looked like they had not showered or eaten a full meal in weeks. They had long hair and they reeked of pot.
Right.
What other company would go, I see potential in you guys?
Yeah, but it worked, obviously, because what they were looking for was a creative individual. And with the Fairchild and the Bally and even the Odyssey at beforehand, they put business guys in charge. I mean, this is IBM versus Apple. IBM with their smart suits and their company songs and the old way of doing thing versus Apple, the new creative computer system. Obviously, this is before that war, but same concept.
We'll get into that when we hit PC games.
Yeah, you had JCPenney and let's see, Magnavox, was that Sears?
I think they were Sears.
Yeah, and again, old companies with the company songs and
the old
suits
way of thinking.
Exactly.
That was the thing, the old way of thinking. Because, like, to those companies, how you would inspire your workers to get the job done would be threatening them or offering them, you know, hey, 2 more vacation days or something. Atari, on the other hand, would be like, hey, you guys get all your programming done and everything works out without a bug, I'll buy you all, you know, a pound of pot, and I'll throw a weekend party at Atari headquarters.
Exactly.
And to a bunch of stoner, just out of high school, college kids, that's a lot more interesting than, you know, oh, I get an extra vacation day next year.
Yeah. And Atari, again, pre-Warner Brothers days, also had this reputation for throwing the most extravagant parties available. Atari at one point threw a party at the Playboy Mansion.
And do you know how they did all this? They did this by a not corporate loophole, but a tax loophole. Because they put everything on the corporate Atari credit card, they were able to claim all of the booze and pot and everything that they were buying as business expenses their taxes. So in essence, it was brilliant, think about it,
dude. It was a gorgeous corporate party. And I mean, and these guys, they went crazy, absolutely crazy. To draw something of a modern parallel to all of this, I remember when I went in 2006, I went out to L.A. to the Podcast and New Media Expo. And it was just the Podcast Expo at that time. And during the day, it was very corporate, and we were trading business cards and we were promoting our podcasts, and of course there were companies there with booths promoting stuff that they
wanted
and host. Well, where I have hosted my podcasts from the beginning is with a company called Libsyn.
Yep.
And Libsyn at that time was an upstart, And they came, and the Libsyn guy that was running the booth, and I forget what his name was, but he was one of the founders. He basically came up and went, "Hey, wait, you're Scott from Satercast." And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You guys are crazy. Hey, we're having this party. It's invitation only. Here." And he hands me this envelope.
Is this like an Eyes Wide Shut kind of thing?
And I'm thinking, okay. So I open up the envelope, and it's got a hotel room listed and a time, and that's it. I mean, there's no Libsyn promotional material. There's nothing else. It's just blah hotel, room blah.
Here, this time.
Yeah, at this time. And I said, okay, we'll be there. And he goes, great, I'm looking forward to it. So I throw that back in the envelope, and I go to the people that I went, and I'm like, okay, well, apparently we're all going, and okay. So I roll on up fashionably late to this party, and this party has spilled out onto the balcony and into the swimming pool, and this is a huge hotel suite. And in one room, they were doing nude body painting. There was another room where all sorts of things were going on that I'm not even going to talk about. There were clouds of various types of smoke, and it had spilled out onto the balcony and again into the swimming pool, and it was one hell of a party. And from what I understand, the Atari parties put that one to absolute shame.
And see, the founder of Atari, his name is escaping.
Nolan Bushnell?
Nolan Bushnell. I was going to say, I feel like an asshole because his name just fell out of my fucking head. But yeah, Nolan Bushnell, he knew how to motivate his people.
Oh, yeah.
He knew how to sell. And after the Atari just started killing in the market, Ralph Baer tried again. And we'll get back to Atari in a few minutes.
That's fine.
Ralph Baer tried again with the Odyssey 2, which was much more of an Atari-style system than what the Odyssey 1 was.
Right.
You know, this had actual games and whatnot.
Cartridges and et cetera, yeah. Et cetera.
And it failed miserably. I think this one was a Sears exclusive. I seem to remember the Odyssey 2. And then Ralph Baer just kind of bowed out. He's like, okay, it's all you. I may have technically invented all this, but you guys are better at it, so... All right, it's on you. It's on you.
Again, Odyssey 2 wasn't a bad system, but it wasn't a huge technological leap from Atari. It didn't offer anything more, but it cost more and it had fewer games. And that was the other thing where Fairchild, Bally, and Odyssey 2 really failed, was all of their games were produced and distributed by the same company that created the machine.
They didn't have third-party developers.
No third-party developers. So it was very...
Which, as we'll find out, is essential to a
Nintendo
system.
Nintendo, are you listening?
We will get to that.
Yeah, I know.
We're not to the 80s yet.
But nonetheless, it was all in-house. There weren't that many games, whereas Atari games were just, 7 to 10 a week were coming out at one point.
Well, that's because you did not have to, because Atari was in a way, the 2600 in a way was open source.
In a way.
That you did not have to even notify Atari that you were making an Atari game.
Right.
You could make a game that would play on the VCS, and they would find out about it when it was on the shelf. Imagine that today. I mean, not counting the Bible knockoffs and those occasional ones.
Right.
But imagine if that was a viable market for the Xbox or the or PlayStation or something today.
Well,
I can make a PlayStation game and I don't have to even license the shit.
Exactly. And we'll get to the problems with that in just a moment. But, you know, the Odyssey 2, it was all developed in-house. Atari, yeah, you could go and the base code was available. It was out there and it was traded like mad and you could create a game like Custer's Revenge.
Exactly.
Or
Beat 'em and Eat 'em.
Yeah, Beat 'em and Eat 'em. Or these X-rated games, so to speak, that
for the time
we look at now and we're like, yeah.
Well, I don't know, Custer's Revenge, you're raping the chicken. You got a giant fucking penis.
Yeah,
that's pretty X-rated.
I know. But you've got that stuff out there. Can you imagine like a company just going triple Xbox, you know? It's
I can totally play with me, Station.
Exactly. Play with yourself, Station.
There you go. But before we get into what happened to Atari and that, we got three competitors showing up.
Yes, that showed up kind of out of the blue.
You had Intellivision, which was a technically superior system. It had better graphics. It had better sound, and I mean better graphics by a leap. If you look at the same games on a 2600 and an Intellivision, it's like looking at a PS3 versus a PlayStation. The graphics were so much more detailed, and they had so many more pixels. They had a much better sound system.
Yes.
And yet, for some reason, they decided, let's make this thing. Well, okay, the VCS, that's for kids, you know?
Yeah.
We're going to target this towards adults.
Yep.
With an adult price tag.
And boy, was it. It was.
It was like $500.
Sub 100 versus, I think, when it first came out, it was like $499.
Well, and even their spokesman, George Plimpton. Yeah,
right.
He's going to get the kids to buy games, right? George
Definitely.
Fucking Plimpton?
Yeah, it shot and wrong. It shot at the wrong target. And now, those that did sell, it was a better, with the exception of the control
system. The controller sucked
ass. The controller was just balls.
But again, that goes to the adult thing. That
right.
They thought, okay, the joystick is for kids. The D-pad isn't invented yet. So the joystick is for kids. So we're going to use a number pad. So if you want to go left, you'll hit 1. You want to go right, you'll hit 3. You want to go up, you'll hit 2 and whatnot. And they thought this is more sophisticated for adults.
And we'll have these crappy little overlays that are going to break after the third time you play the game. And
yeah, it was not a well thought out. It almost seemed like they rushed into it, except the hardware argues the fact that they didn't, that they took their time to improve on it. It seems like the marketing rushed into this without thinking their clever plan all the way through.
Yes, but nonetheless, so the Intellivision comes along and it makes a dent. Not a big one, but a little dent.
And then the other big competitor comes in, and which is ColecoVision, the toy company. Coleco decides,
Connecticut Leather Company.
Well, we all know them from Coleco Toys.
Right, but that's where Coleco gets its name. Coleco. Connecticut Leather Company. They were a textile and leather giant at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries. And I mean, they had this empire behind them. Coleco leather was some of the best leather you could buy out there. And it was the son of one of the bigwigs in the company that goes, let's give video games a try. I like playing video games. And so they came in with ColecoVision and got involved in an entire electronics division.
Well, and see, the problem with ColecoVision, for whatever reason, they did not market it towards adults, but they kept that same shitty Intellivision controller.
Right.
That same design of the keypad instead of the joystick. I don't understand that, but whatever. But the graphics weren't as good as the Intellivision.
Right.
They were about equal to the Atari. The sound wasn't as good, so it was kind of like adding a retarded, I'm here too, guys!
Well, to be fair, the ColecoVision was the middle system. You had the Intellivision, which was high-end, and that was marketed towards adults and such. You had the Atari 2600, which should be in every house in America.
Which was marketed towards everybody,
but especially families and kids. And then you had the ColecoVision. It was a minor improvement over the Atari, but it wasn't anywhere near Intellivision.
And the price point could have been where they took Atari's thunder, but they, just like Intellivision,
again,
said,
they shot for that $300 price point versus $99.99. That was a huge, huge deal. And people went, you know, for three times the money, I should be getting three times the system. And even looking at Intellivision, they would say,
on a technical level,
technical level, you were a little bit better, but you weren't quite to that five times the system deal. It was better, but
well, I
not
think
five times better.
I think I know where Intellivision's marketing head was. It's kind of like the same thing that happened with Laserdiscs over VHS. How Laserdiscs were marketed towards the true film fan. You know, you want the widescreen, you want the commentary, you want the liner notes from the director. That's the way Laserdisc was marketed. Over video, anybody can do that.
Right.
That's almost what Intellivision was like. You want the crisper games, the cleaner gameplay, the better scrolling. that almost seems like it was the true video game fan will buy Intellivision. Right. At least that's where I think their marketing ideals were heading. And it was just at the time they were, like you said, they were overshooting. They were hitting the wrong audience.
Right.
Because kids were the bulk of the video game market at this point.
And my cousin had an Intellivision and had just about every game for it. But my uncle was a neurosurgeon. they could afford it. And
Intellivision also had one amazing add-on you could get too. That there's something.
The voice synthesizer or?
No, the Atari player.
Oh,
you
that's
could,
right.
You could buy an add-on that would actually allow you to play Atari carts on your Intellivision.
Now, to be fair.
Today, that's illegal as shit today.
Yeah, to be fair, that was developed by neither Intellivision nor Atari.
Yeah, that was third party.
That was again, a third party company.
And both companies went, whoa.
Yeah. And they were sued out of existence pretty darn quickly.
But just the fact, that's a ballsy move.
Well, it's been done again with like the Bleem.
I don't even know what that is.
The Bleem was something that you could throw into your PC and allowed you to play PlayStation games on your PC.
Oh, okay.
It was an emulator, and it's been tried again, and no company has really survived. Yeah.
Well, and then there's one other little competitor. They did not last long, but I know you remember the Vectrex.
Well, my friend Greg had one.
Do you remember the Vectrex? Play the commercial. Obviously, you guys can't see it, but do you remember this?
This is an ordinary TV video game. This is Vectrex, the only video game system with its own video screen. Take it anywhere. Just plug it in. It's your own personal arcade. A high-performance system with a built-in game plus a whole collection of arcade cartridges like Scramble, Pole Position, Berserk. So if you're into video games, forget the TV. Get into Vectrex. Light pen and 3D imager available.
And again, you heard Light Pen, and Light Pen was a big seller for Vectrex. And my friend Greg had one. It really wasn't a bad system.
Honestly, the biggest drawback was, I've seen a couple at the used video game stores, mm-hmm. and from every video I've seen online, was the lighting behind for the screen was so loud, the hum actually started at some points to drown out the sound effects of the game.
Yeah, and that was actually cooling system as well as this, you know, you pack a TV
into that. It's a really compressed space, yeah. Honestly.
And it's a 16:9 TV turned vertically,
which always seemed like an odd choice to me. It's kind of like the opposite of a movie screen, which is horizontal.
Right.
But it was
all vector graphics.
Which means essentially straight lines.
Essentially straight lines and a very distinct look. The old classic Star Wars arcade.
Oh yeah,
cabinet was vector graphics. Tempest was another one with vector graphics.
The old Star Trek one too. There was a Star Trek one that I remember, and that was actually on. That was ported to the Vectrex. I remember playing
and
that.
It wasn't a bad system. Now, again, we had problems of overlays because vector graphics are not capable of color.
They're black and white.
They're
and
monochromatic.
That's it.
And, well, at the time, Star Wars came around and
you were able to add some of that like rainbow effect with your photon or whatever.
Right, Star Wars, you had.
I think I just pissed off tons of Star Wars fans by calling it photon torpedoes, which is from Star Trek. Their heads just exploded.
I know, but the Vectrex machine was monochromatic, just because of the way it was. So again, game companies went, well, that's okay. We'll take a piece of plastic and we'll just put that over the screen and boom, colorized.
And probably the worst design move outside of the hum was the controller, something that we'll be talking about again later because a couple other companies thought of this same stupid thing. Not that the controller was bad. It had an incredibly short cord. So you basically had to sit right in. I mean, yes, the screen wasn't big, but you couldn't sit back and have that sitting on a table while you're in a chair.
It was about an 8-inch cord.
Yeah, you have to basically crunch up in front of this screen.
And the controller
that's not very well thought out.
Yeah, and the controller, when you weren't using the system, would tuck underneath the machine. Again, not a bad design because it would tuck underneath.
Well, the whole thing was for quick storage, and you could take it with you.
Exactly, and the cord would wrap up in the back and everything like that. But the games that I played on it were fun. The light pen, again, built in, was responsive. The controller, aside from having the cord that was way too short, was not a bad controller. Arcade quality buttons that wouldn't... one of the problems with the 2600 was your joystick wore out real quick.
Yeah.
There's a little rubber membrane between the that would slip over the actual plastic joystick.
I've destroyed them before. I've seen it's what they look like inside.
And yeah, they would be destroyed. The button would inevitably fail.
Also the button had that weird little concave center that would really start to irritate your thumb after a while.
Yeah, and the Vectrex, I will give them props for their controller. Nice little metal.
Because the button, instead of being concave...
It was flat.
No, it was rounded, so it was slightly rounded, so your finger rested on it nicely and kind of slid around on it without falling off, if I'm remembering right.
No, I don't think you're remembering right, because it had two buttons, and they were flat.
Okay, I don't remember. I remember it being just a little bit bubbled. Okay,
but the joystick was a bit shorter, had a bit more travel.
It was almost a thumbstick.
Had a touch more travel to it, and it was metal, and there was no rubber cover thing.
It recentered properly.
Right. Well, it recentered using springs as opposed to.
And we'll be talking about recentering in a little bit.
Yeah, but. That was the Vectrex. It wasn't a bad little system. It really wasn't.
So this was the first Battleground. This is what's called the first generation.
Right.
And Atari basically won this hands down. At one point, Nolan Bushnell decided he kind of saw what would happen in 1983 coming and said, you know what? I'm getting out now.
I'm going to start making pizza places.
Yeah, he started making Showbiz. Chucky.
Showbiz.
No, he made Showbiz. That's right. And so he sold Atari to Warner Brothers. And when Warner Brothers came in, they did what every independent company when they're bought by a conglomerate. They destroyed the company. And within 2 years, they were bankrupt within 2 years. So way to go, Warner Brothers management. You really knew what you were doing, fuckheads. And one of the first things that they did, they fired almost all of the weird people, you know, like that Wozni Jobs team.
Well,
you guys are just stoner potheads. We don't need you.
They fired all of the weird people, and the weird people went out and said, okay, we'll just make a game company, and became Activision.
Not yet. No, you're jumping ahead a little bit. They fired all the weird people, and what the actual impetus for the creation of Activision was that the creators said, you know, I'd like a cut of the game. That, you know, we our blood, sweat, and tears is in this, and I'd like, say, I think what they wanted was a percent of every cartridge sold.
Right. It was a very small percentage of every cartridge sold, and they wanted credits on the cartridge.
And I'm quoting here from the Warner Brothers executive, which is probably one of the stupidest quotes in corporate history. We don't need you. I can get anybody to program this game. I'm quoting again here. You are no more important to the success of this game than the person on the assembly line putting it together. How do you insult the programmer more than that? You're basically telling them, get fucked.
Actually, there was one way, and I forget the exact quote, but Warner Brothers was... Have you ever heard the term code monkey?
No.
It's almost a badge of honor by programmers, and code monkey being one that sits down at the computer and types code and,
right,
you know, boom, program. It was an executive at Warner Brothers that basically said, like you said, we don't need you. You're no important, more important. And there was another one that went, yes, we could hire a bunch of monkeys to put this code together.
And they Bell basically said, fuck you. You know, obviously, Jobs and Wozniak went into computers. They didn't go into video games as much. You know, they eventually took their buyout from Warner Brothers because, you know, they had contracts. So they weren't just fired. They were paid to leave.
Right.
Here's a dump truck full of money. Go away. And Activision was formed. The thing with Activision was they gave credit. I mean, right there on the box, you know, programmed by such and such.
Yep.
And the programmers almost became rock stars.
Yes.
To the fans. That was unheard of. And Warner Brothers refused to do that. Actual Atari produced games would not put that because fuck you. You know, you're replaceable.
Exactly. Yeah.
And Activision started making games. As we said, the Atari was kind of open source. So they just started, and these are the guys that made it. So even if it wasn't open source, they know the fucking source.
Exactly.
So.
And these are the games that when it comes to Atari that most people remember. Pitfall. Yeah.
Yep.
Any of those with that kind of swoopy rainbow graphic that was on the front of the...
Yeah, that was
a
part of Activision's logo.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of others, but there were a bunch out there, and they're generally when you think of an Atari 2600 game, which
ironically enough, it is not... Most of what people think of when they think of the 2600 was not Atari-produced games.
Exactly.
They were third-party.
Exactly. With the exception of two. E.T. and Combat.
We're going to get into E.T. in a minute. You're still jumping ahead a little bit with E.T.
I'm not jumping ahead. I'm foreshadowing.
Ah, okay. I gotcha. So what happened was Warner Brothers basically corporatized everything. They got rid of all the parties. And then Pac-Man happened. What you know, Pac-Man was a monster hit in the arcade by
Pac-Man was not just a hit in the arcade, it was a hit, it was a lifestyle because you had Pac-Man rock songs
and cereals and cartoons,
cereals
and all
and
that,
cartoons
right.
And stuffed animals and everything and its brother. I mean, Pac-Man hit a nerve in at least, I hesitate to say worldwide. It was definitely recognized worldwide.
It was multicultural, though, because Japan hit.
Right. But
they loved it, too.
But at least here in America, just a cultural nerve that just blew up.
And they said, we need to have this.
We
got to
have this for
the
26, yeah.
And the problem with that was they said, we want it by Christmas. And this is Christmas 82. Christmas 83 will be a bigger disaster. But Christmas 82, they said, we have to have Pac-Man for this.
This is a classic mistake by video game publishers that is still
being
made.
That will be repeated,
made.
Yes.
Is still being repeated, EA. And it is just really being pushed by a lot, Bethesda. And we have got to get over this shit.
The Christmas season.
But this is the first real iteration of what happened was with Pac-Man. They got the idea in March or April.
And they said,
have it by Christmas. Have it by November.
And literally, to be able to make the motherboards, if you can call what's inside that a motherboard, but to make the boards, to put the cartridges, to get the artwork, to get all the packaging, to get all the shipping orders, et cetera, normally, you would have about...
18 months.
Yeah, you'd have a long programming time. They had 6 weeks of programming for Pac-Man. And the guy that made it, to get it out by Christmas, Warner Brothers gave him a $1 million bonus if he could have it done by Christmas. Problem is, they didn't specify it had to be good.
Exactly.
It just had to be done and work.
Yeah.
Not and, work well, just work.
And I believe... Pac-Man was, you know, we had this because we had a VCS at the house. We had Pac-Man, and I think my dad played it twice, and I played it a few more times than that, and then the cartridge mysteriously disappeared someday, you know.
Well, because the problems with Pac-Man were numerous, but for one, the short programming time, that was a huge roadblock. But
right.
Then also just the VCS's system limitations. You could not do that many characters on screen at one time that would move. That's why the ghost blinked. It could literally only animate one ghost per frame.
Right.
That's why the ghosts blink in that, because you can't have 4 or 5, counting Pac-Man, things that are moving on the screen at one time. literally, I mean, and even more programming time wouldn't have helped this because this was a system limitation.
Right.
This could, that could not have been helped. But so they had to redesign. They had to really take the rather iconic sound effects out because they couldn't even come close to emulating those.
Exactly.
And they couldn't put in multiple levels, you know, different mazes and whatnot. They changed the mazes that there were. It was a complete and utter disaster. And in a way, it's the programming time is a factor, but it's not the only factor. We cannot blame the programmer solely on this.
Right.
Because he could not have performed magic. This is not some voodoo ritual where we can get the arcade Pac-Man on a VCS. That was never going to happen.
And on top of that, Warner Brothers, this was the first case of rights being bought for a property.
Yeah, because again, this is not I almost said Nintendo. This is not an Atari-owned concept. They had to license it from
Namco.
Namco. I wanted to say Taito, but I knew that wasn't right.
Nope.
Namco. They had to license it, which cost a lot.
Right.
And this thing was such a disaster. They tried it as, like I pointed out earlier, the pack-in title. They tried it as. There are commercials out there. You buy the 2600, it comes with Pac-Man. You'll notice they don't show you any footage from it, but you get Pac-Man.
Yeah.
And Pac-Man sold like crazy because nobody saw it yet. They didn't know what a piece of shit it was. So when it was out for that Christmas season, Warner Brothers made a fucking killing, Scott.
Yep.
Until people played it Christmas morning, they went, the fuck is this?
God. Yeah.
This isn't Pac-Man. See, but that was the thing with Space Invaders. Space Invaders was a really accurate transition because Space Invaders did not tax the hardware.
Right.
You know, because Space Invaders came out, 4 years earlier?
Yeah, something like
that. So Space Invaders was an accurate transition. So people thought, well, Space Invaders was a pretty accurate arcade to console transition. Pac-Man will be too. And the public didn't realize why that did not happen.
And it was...
could not happen.
It was a truly awful, awful game.
And then let's round out this episode with just going through the video game crash of 83. And then Atari decided the next year, E.T. came out in 1982, the movie.
Yes.
And they licensed from Spielberg, again licensing...
And paid a pretty penny to do so.
They paid a lot. And yes, and you know what? People like to forget this. Steven Spielberg was heavily involved in the development of what became that E.T. disaster. People like to forget that he was overseeing and essentially executive producing that game.
Yes.
People like to absolve him of that. No. That's partially his fault, fuckos.
Yeah. He wrote the story for the game, so...
And he also okayed everything.
Yes.
Nothing happened in that game without Spielberg's specific okay.
That's true.
But they wanted E.T., and again, we gotta have it out by Christmas. So, again, it was a rush job, and the title screen looked nice. The theme music actually was relatively close. Yeah.
The title screen looked really good. The sound of the game, the sound of the theme music was really nice.
So when you first popped it in, you went, oh,
then
all
you
right.
played it.
Yeah.
And you went, if I fall into another goddamn pit.
If I hear that,
you could not move on the screen without either. I mean, go online and just watch an online review of E.T. the video game because it was awful.
It was terrible. And basically what happened was, again, because they rushed it, but there were other factors in the video game crash here, was you still had ColecoVision and Intellivision and whatnot putting out their stuff. You know, Fairchild and Bally, they're gone.
Fairchild and Bally had disappeared at this point.
They're,
right.
They're long gone. The Odyssey's long gone. Vectrex is long gone. So it is three competitors, which is a theme we'll see again and again as we're moving on. That seems to be how this works. There's three people competing. Atari has 78% of the video game market at this point,
yes.
Which only leaves Intellivision and ColecoVision to fight over that last 22%. Not a good ratio there.
No. And ColecoVision really just utterly
lost.
Failed
yeah.
at this point.
Intellivision controlled a good chunk of that last 22%,
right.
too.
Right.
And because of it being open source and anyone being able to make an Atari game, the market was flooded with them. And we're talking You've heard the term shovelware, right, Scott?
Yes.
It was just so much shovelware.
Oh, yeah.
Because at least Atari games, not counting Pac-Man, E.T. and whatnot, to a degree, especially Activision games, they attempted a level of quality.
Well, yeah. I mean, look at Pitfall. Look at Turbo. Look at Night Driver.
They at least worked as they were supposed to.
They worked as they were supposed to. However, since anybody in and their brother could get in on this huge Atari market, you were flooded with, not just flooded with games, but flooded with bad, ugly, and practically unplayable
games that were obviously out there to take your quick buck and then like a fly-by-night artist, and then he's gone and you've never heard of the CEO again.
And you had companies, blink in and out of existence, just blink in, make a game, go away.
There was a lot of them that would make a game.
Yes.
They would sell, 100,000 copies, and then they'd go away, and they would have made a tidy profit.
Yes.
And what they did is they just oversaturated the market. There were so many video games, and then after the Pac-Man debacle, and then after the E.T. debacle, E.T. actually, see, unlike Pac-Man, people kept the game. It still was essentially Pac-Man, just a shitty version.
Yeah.
E.T. had a record number of returns. People were like, you know what? No, I want my money back.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Atari lost, Warner Brothers specifically, lost a shit ton of money on that.
Yep.
And that eventually caused the entire industry to implode in 1983. The video game crash of 83. Yeah,
that
and everyone died.
That on top of the crappy XXX games that there were some kids that got their hands on.
Charles Band of Full Moon, then Empire, released the Halloween and Texas Chainsaw Massacre horror games. Remember those?
Yes.
And those were Charles Band.
Yep. And there was a big old parents, because this was right around the time of the Satanic Panic.
No, you're actually about 2 years early. The Satanic Panic hit about in 85, 86.
Okay, so. But this was kind of, this was still not quite to Family Values time, but.
This was the Mazes and Monsters role-playing game panic.
Right, and it, some kids got their hands on both horror games, and some kids got their hands on the XXX games, and you had mom that was upset and dad that was more upset that obviously they
found out about the XXX game.
Exactly. And because I remember when my dad brought home Custer's Revenge, dad kind of knew what he was looking at. Mom didn't. We played and mom came in and was like,
what the hell?
No. And so our Custer's Revenge
went away.
Which is a shame, because I'd love to have that cart now just to have the cart.
Hell, if you have the box and the book, too. Jesus, well, are those worth a lot?
Yeah, I know. But so that's it. The market got flooded with crap.
Which, again, is a theme we're going to see a few more times in this little series we're doing on Lost in the Static here.
Exactly.
That's not the first time we're going to be talking about
that,
Scott.
And, of course, this is obviously pre-ESRB, so parents had a hard time understanding what was in the game. And even let's even take out the XXX side. Let's say you're a parent and you don't want your kid playing violent video games, and well, you pick up one called Speed Defender or something like that, and it ends up being a shoot 'em up, or you end up getting a Wild West game where, like, Quick Draw, and maybe a parent looked at that and went,
you're
a drawing
people.
Program
yeah.
You know, and then
you're shooting
people. And we had, there were a couple of games that were the beginning of pixelated blood.
Yeah. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre one, I think, had some.
Yeah, Texas Chainsaw and Friday the 13th had some, too.
Friday the 13th didn't have anything until the Nintendo.
It didn't? Okay.
No, Halloween. Halloween and Texas Chainsaw,
that's what I was
the
thinking.
Ones Band had.
But nonetheless, so you went through this, and as a parent, it was impossible to tell what your kids were getting into and what games you were picking up and all that, so. Yeah, this was the beginning of the problems, and it just collapsed.
And it seemed like this was it, that the video game industry, the bubble had done burst and everyone inside had suffocated.
It was a good run. Let's concentrate on computers.
And next week we'll look at what happened after the video game crash. So remember, guys, go to 1201beyond.com, buy some t-shirts, use the Amazon links. And also go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code STATIC. We'll be back next week to deal with the second generation of video games, which is the one that Scott and I remember way more vividly than us just reiterating history to you like we did tonight.
Oh, yeah. Goodbye, everybody.
Lost in the Static is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.